Hello and welcome to another episode of Soccer Cast Chicago. I'm Alex Campbell. The Red Stars have had a few days off and are looking ahead to their regular season debut against the Portland Thorns next Saturday, the 15th of May. Meanwhile, the Fire are preparing to welcome the defending Supporters Shield champions and current CONCACAF Champions League semifinalists, the Philadelphia Union, to Soldier Field on Saturday. To get you all set for that game, I spoke to Matt Ralph from Brotherly Game, the Philadelphia Union site at SB Nation. We talked about the Union's CCL campaign so far, Jim Curtin, the departures of Brendan Aaronson and Mark McKenzie, as well as the team's struggles so far in MLS play this season while prioritizing the CCL. But a couple of notes before we get to that conversation about the latest news in Chicago soccer. This week, the NWSL completed its investigation into the incident that occurred following the Red Stars Challenge Cup opener in Houston, when Sarah Gordon's boyfriend was racially profiled by stadium security. There isn't a lot to say about the NWSL's response at the end of their investigation because they didn't say very much. Just that there will be no fines assessed and that the league will not be commenting further on the matter. The Red Stars also said when asked by media that they are not allowed to comment. We can assume that if they did, they would probably be fined much like they were when Sarah Spain simply tweeted that she supported Sarah Gordon after the incident happened. And it really doesn't sit right that the only punishments in any of this were for a three-word tweet by Spain and Gotham GM Elise LaHue also voicing her support on Twitter for Sarah Gordon. We've seen a few Red Stars players post statements on social media reasserting their support for Sarah, and it does appear that much like when the investigation began, that unlike the team, players have no such ban on speaking on the matter. But bottom line, this investigation started with a black player pointing this out as an example of how not only black players, but black fans often don't feel that soccer is a safe place for them. And it ends with absolutely no addressing of that fact and no actions or statements to Sarah or to all black supporters in the soccer community at large that they take this issue seriously. And if the league can't act because of their current policies, maybe those policies need updating. The NWSL Players Association is currently negotiating its first ever collective bargaining agreement, and I hope that given how this all played out, that this situation is something that comes up and that is addressed in those discussions so that in the future the league is in a better position when players or, you know, fans or whoever at an NWSL game experiences this sort of thing, that there is outlined recourse for how these things should be handled and not simply an untransparent process that ends with no answers whatsoever and the league simply saying they're not going to tell us why there was no fines, how they came to that decision. And again, we're all just left to sit here and question it, and I don't understand how the league thinks they can have any credibility with anyone, whether it's Sarah Gordon, other players, fans, anybody, when they simply say, we didn't do anything, and we're not going to explain to you why. On the Fire side, discussions are ongoing to loan a player or players up to Foran Madison for the upcoming USL League One season. The most likely candidate would probably be Chris Brady, who excelled on loan there last year, was the USL League One Goalkeeper of the Year. As for outfield players like Javier Casas, Brian Gutierrez, or Alex Moniz, with all the injuries right now, I'm not sure the club would feel comfortable letting any outfield players leave, so I feel confident we're going to see Brady or Slonina go out on loan this year, but beyond that, maybe we see something later in the year once the squad is healthier, but I just think things are a little too thin right now to see anyone else depart. In my conversation with Matt Ralph, we mainly talk Union, so a couple thoughts on the Fire. First, I would largely echo my Hot Time in Old Town colleague Pat McCraney's column about everything that's gone wrong so far this season on the field and where the team might go from here. As far as Saturday's game, I don't want to see the same lineup or roughly same lineup against Philly. Clearly, this team needs a shuffle or needs some sort of message sent. Maybe that means you sit Kapelhoff or Calvo at center back, and I know that causes other problems if you move Mauricio Pineda into the back line. What do you do in midfield? And speaking of midfield, I think we've seen that a pivot of Gaston Jimenez and Alvaro Medrón just doesn't have enough defensive, you know, commitment, steel, skill, whatever you want to call it, in it. Those two players, it's not really their ilk. It's not really their tendency. So how do you fix that? I mean, last game we saw Medrón played as a winger. That didn't really work. And I think it's still a very open question how you fit him and Luka Stojanovic effectively into the same lineup. And they're maybe the two most talented players on this team, so they should both be on the field, but that's a task for Rafael Wicki to figure out. And I really hope we see some youth in this game. Maybe either Espinoza, Navarro, or both starting at fullback. Maybe one of the kids gets a shot in midfield. Maybe the formation gets shaken up. It's just not working right now. Everyone can see that it's not really a mystery. And this is as vulnerable as you're ever going to get Philly. They've struggled in MLS so far this year as they've prioritized the Champions League. And give it another week or two, they're going to be fully rested, fully fit, and have their best 11 going in every MLS game. So there's no better time to play these guys. And the Fire have to show this weekend that they understand how important this game is, not just for turning momentum around, not just for getting a result, maybe their first win of the year, but because when you look at the whole schedule, the 34 games, you know, there's going to be tough games, there's going to be tough teams. Philly are one of the best teams in this league, and you've got to take advantage of playing them at the right time. Unfortunately, I can't be at Saturday's game, so follow Pat McCraney for all your Fire game day coverage needs. Now, after a quick break, my conversation with Matt Ralph of Brotherly Game. Welcome back to SoccerCast Chicago, and this weekend the Fire are back home at Soldier Field to take on the CONCACAF Champions League semifinalists, the Philadelphia Union. So to preview Saturday's matchup, I'm joined now by Matt Rolfe, the managing editor of Brotherly Game, the home of the Union at SB Nation. Matt, thanks so much for taking the time to come on SoccerCast Chicago today.
Thanks for having me on, Alex, and I appreciate the pronunciation, even though it's not right, but my family at one time was Rolf. It's Ralph, but no, that's cool. I like that, actually. that makes me sound more interesting than just Ralph. Like, Ralph sounds like a guy around the block. Rolf sounds like someone with some actual expertise.
All right, so maybe it's a mistake that Yeah, that's my bad, but
that's fine.
If it makes it sound more interesting, I guess that works.
Yeah.
So I want to start with the 2-leg victory over Atlanta United to reach the CCL semis. This is the first year the Union have ever even been in this competition, and now they're in the Final Four. What's kind of the mood around the team right now? How is the fan base taken to this run the Union are on in CCL?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's really exciting. You know, it's a new experience going into the competition, not really, you know, I don't think having like necessarily high expectations, just because it's, you know, first time in competition, you just really don't know how it's going to go, you know, and I think the first game was a little nerve wracking in, even though they were in Saprissa without fans, which was a bonus for them. You know, it was a 1-0 win on the road, and you're feeling positive, but, you know, kind of still feeling like, hey, you know, what's going to happen in this second game? And then to go into the break scoreless, you're like, okay, well, an away goal, you know, conceding here, this could be a difficult thing, but, you know, they get penalties, and I don't really know what penalties are in CONCACAF Champions League, especially not after last night, but they get a penalty, you go up, and then once they got that goal, it was, you know, Saprissa was severely shorthanded in the back, and they made them pay. And then, you know, you go to Atlanta, and you expect them, Atlanta was not good last year, right? So you don't, and you know, you wonder why a team that finished 23rd place is in a Champions League, but you know, you go there, you think, okay, like, you know, maybe they can steal something here, in front of 20,000 fans, and then they get the goal, and which was massive. And then you watch Atlanta and you're like, wait, what, did they not realize this is a 2-leg competition?
Right.
And then benefited, and ultimately, you know, at home did what they had to do, you know, so. The thing about it is, you know, it's new for Union fans, of course, but it's not, there's no style points. It's about winning and advancing. And obviously Jim Curtin knows about that as a experience as a Chicago Fire player. And, he's a knockout competition coach. I mean, he knows, he's had a lot of success even in his academy days, winning the GA Cup, and you know, he knows how to coach in these games. I mean, you could say, you know, the naysayers will say, well, he lost 3 Open Cup finals, but look at the teams he had in those Open Cup finals. And obviously won it as a player with, you know, arguably one of the best teams in MLS history that he was on. You look across that Fire roster and it's like, you know, are there any people on that team that aren't coaching now somewhere?
I was going to say, you've got Jim, you've got Jesse Marsh, you've got Chris Armas. I mean, of course, Bob Bradley was one of the youngest coaches in the league,
yeah,
running the show over there. Yeah, it's an incredible thing. It was actually brought up in a Fire presser this week that it's that Fire team and Chivas USA from like the next decade, which is now full of people coaching, including Rafael Wicky.
Right. Yeah. It's wild. Jim kind of is he's a guy you want coaching in this competition, and you especially want him coaching when, you know, people are counting him out. You know, he's a guy who has been, you know, overlooked and unappreciated like his entire sporting life, whether that's on the soccer field and on a basketball court, because he was a good basketball player as a teenager too. But, you know, he's just a guy who, it's almost like it feeds him. And right. you saw him in his exchange with Gabriel Heinze the other night, and his comments that, you know, I said, you know, he's gone from, you know, a great MLS coach to a star of MLS now overnight, with the attention that's come from, you know, him, you know, calling out a coach for, I mean, come on, shake the guy's hand, you know, you just gave him, you know, even more, attention, which I think is, he deserves attention, not for, you know, swearing in a press conference. He deserves attention for being a great coach. And for really taking a team that, you know, you look at on paper is not necessarily a top four North American team, but, you know, he's there and he deserves to be there, and he deserves all the praise and the credit for getting that far.
I've only ever had the chance to speak to Jim once, and it was one of those really just enjoyable soccer conversations, because you can immediately tell he's a guy who thinks so deeply about the game. And it is awesome, especially from a Chicago perspective, to see him have the success he's had. I was going to save this question for a bit later, but given that we're talking about Jim Curtin, part of why I enjoy watching the Union play, especially so far in the Champions League this season, is to me, they've got a very clear system. They have a very discernible style of play. Jim's been there a long time, but would it be safe to say that over the last 12 months, he has kind of achieved his idyllic vision of how he wants a team to play? Is this kind of the last 12 months-ish kind of the final form of a Jim Curtin soccer team, do you think?
I think so, because, I think a Jim Curtin soccer team, it really begins in the locker room. And that's not a slight on him as a tactician or his just knowledge and appreciation for the game. Sometimes you feel like he'd much rather just sit around and talk about other teams than his own team, and tactics and competitions around the world, just because he's such a student, just an appreciator of the game. But, you know, the way he leads the team, and, you know, before the Champions League game here the other night, they played a video on they have an enormous screen. Maybe it's Soldier Field, probably has an even bigger one because everything's big there. But they played in where he's in the, you know, giving that like pregame talk and, you know, talking about it, you just sort of see that, you know, no pun intended, that fire in him as a coach, and just how he, the way he leads from within the organization, within the team, the way he is with his players in training, and finally getting to see him in training again, which is, you know, I was like, hey Jim, I haven't seen you work for a long time, this is great, you know, because the games aren't necessarily work, that's you know, the work is in the training, and and the ways that he's, you know, working with his staff, and the ways that they're in the video room, and they're you know, studying things and lining things up. But I definitely think the way he leads in the locker room, the way he leans on, you know, players like Alejandro Bedoya, again, like, he's coming from this environment where he was in a locker room with all of these future coaches, right? And I don't know at the time like who you would have picked out of that team that would be other coaches, but, you know, he was definitely around people like Chris and who were a big influence on him as a player. And so I think, you know, having had that experience of being on teams that that really came together as a team. He's just taken that experience and really run with it. And I think, you know, initially, you know, you come in as a coach, he was an interim. I mean, they're interviewing people for his job and mm-hmm. you know, while he's out, you know, while he's in the building, you know, and he really had to prove himself. But, you know, I think just like, you know, just who he is as a person, the way he carries himself, and you know, there's a reason people were kind of shocked the way, you know, the way he talked about Heinze, because he doesn't, it's not like a normal thing that he would.
No,
yeah. he didn't call him an asshole. He said he was acting like one, but that's, even that is kind of, you know, that's not necessarily his, he doesn't just pick fights with people. That's not his style. Right. And so, you know, if anything, usually what you hear from Jim is he's praising the other coach. You know, he undoubtedly today he will talk very highly, speak very highly of Rafael. You know, like he's you know, he was a big fan of Pano before him. You know, like he's a guy who appreciates the other coaches and usually is the one, you know, when Chris is on the hot seat in Red Bull, he's like, yeah, that's not fair. Like, Chris is doing a great job. You know, he's a guy kind of sticking up.
He's going to stick up for his guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and he's big, you know, big fan, obviously, of Oscar and what he's doing, you know, down in Orlando as well. So, yeah, so, you know, it's not like a small thing that he's come out. But I do think him has a leader in the locker room, and the way he really just embraces you know, the players in a way that, you know, he's not an easy coach on his players, but he's someone who gets, I think, maximum effort and maximum buy-in from the group that he has. And otherwise, you know, they don't have the personnel to accomplish what they've accomplished without something else happening within the organization, within the buy. I mean, he talked about, I think one of the things, you know, he talked about after the Atlanta United game, because I asked him about how, you know, this is a pattern with you guys where, you know, everyone's like thinking, oh no, this isn't your night. You have a bad first half, and then you score that first goal, and then you're pouring it on. And you know, one of the things he said is that, you know, it's in the moments when things aren't working that you really see a team come together, because it's like, okay, if it's not working, are you going to start yelling at each other and getting at each other and getting frustrated and letting another team just basically own you? Or are you going to stick to the principle, stick to the game plan, knowing that if you do that, you know, there's going to be a payoff. And I think that's what has happened. It's the payoff of, okay, I don't know, this 4-4-2 thing at first was like kind of a disaster, right? And
you it's know, different. It's not something you see, like a 4-4-2 diamond is not something you see in MLS. I don't think there's anybody else running it. Yep. And again, I think that's part of what's become really unique about the Union is it's, you know, you know what the Philadelphia Union look like. Like when they step on the field, you know what to expect, you know what they're going to look like. And, you know, yeah, it was a mess for a while, but now, you know, that it's all kind of come together, it really does stand out. And it shows when teams aren't really sure what to do with it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's also a system that you can, you know, it's not reliant necessarily on any particular player. It's reliant on getting the right players for that system. Mm-hmm. But it's because so much of it depends on, you know, all 11 players on the field, like buying into it. And you've seen some departures within the team in the last few years who either they didn't necessarily buy in or they didn't fit it. Like, you know, Fabian Herbers was not a fit in that system. And, he's a player I've always liked, but he didn't fit in that system. You know, a number of players who've left over the years either didn't fit in the system or, you know, their value was such that, you know, you could collect that, those sweet Garber bucks and bring in a player who maybe fits the system better or allows a player to fill that spot that you want to bring up through the academy and all those things. So, it definitely is a, it's kind of you see what you get and, you know, and I think there's still, there's still some concern, you know, even within matches sometimes because of how it can break down and you can have nights where, especially, you know, with tired legs where, it can be exploited.
For sure. So on the CCL, the semifinals against Mexico's Club America aren't until August, so plenty of time to look forward to that. But before we get to this weekend, you mentioned departures. I do want to back up a little bit because it was a really eventful offseason for the Philadelphia Union. Saw, of course, the departures of Brendan Aaronson to RB Salzburg in Austria, Mark McKenzie to Genk in Belgium. Matt, what were your expectations for the Union this year? You know, they win the Supporters' Shield. You see these two really promising young players leave. How big a loss did you think those two guys were going to be for the Union this season? How big of a change did you expect?
I mean, you can't really downplay how important those two players were to the team. Again, you know, to kind of go into the whole locker room, like culture of the club. And, you know, I can't really think of two players who personify that more than those two, because I mean, Mark McKenzie is just such a leader. I mean, he's kind of one of those people who's like he was a leader when he was 11, playing with people older than him. And Brendan's more of a quiet force on the field, but he's also someone who just has his head on straight and just works, you know, will outwork just about anybody his age. And, you know, he's always the last one to leave training. And let's not forget, I mean, he's just a very, very fast, skilled, smart, all of the adjectives type of player. And so you can tell they're not there. I mean, it's definitely a loss. I mean, from a leadership standpoint, I think they're, you know, you still obviously have Bedoya and, you know, but losing Gattis and losing McKenzie, like, is, and I would also add Warren Cravall into that mix of players who, you know, it's no surprise they were the players who were, you know, more vocal, on the non-soccer front of things too, speaking out about, you know, the reaction to the murder of George Floyd and, you know, rallying their team around, you know, things that are more important than soccer. So, and there's a galvanizing effect when you have players like that. And then you have like an Andre Blake, who's a tremendous presence in the locker room. You don't necessarily see that. And like, he's not a vocal person, and he's not a person who is like out front and, you know, like Mark, basically, like, you give him a microphone and, you know, get ready for some great quotes and get ready for, you know, just to learn things from every time Mark talks. Cause he's such an amazing young man, amazing speaker, amazing. Like, he's just very, I mean, he has his own podcast and he's killing that now too. Right. So it's hard to like really, I mean, I feel like you can't overstate how much of a loss it was. Obviously, you know, it's a game, right? It's a business, and it's beneficial to them. It's beneficial to the club. But, you know, I do think, you know, it's still a situation where they have their, you know, they can kind of fill in, you know, and they have their system. The system doesn't break because two players leave.
Right.
And,
yeah.
It does feel like, especially in league play right now, you know, with, they're still trying to figure some things out. And I think the transition game without Brendan is not as dangerous as it was. I mean, I still think one of the things that, you know, people were hard on him here for not scoring more goals, not getting more assists, but is, you know, the, in terms of assists that don't count as assists, I mean,
right.
He, you know, especially MLS's back, he created, I mean, other than set pieces, like, there weren't many goals he wasn't involved in.
Right, yeah.
Even though I don't even know how many, like, I think he had a couple of assists on the score sheet. But he was just a guy in transition, you know. We would always say last year, if he has the ball in the final third and there's numbers, forget about it. It's a goal.
Right.
You
mentioned that it's been, you know, a little bumpy to start the season in league play. Obviously, Jim Curtin has prioritized the Champions League. But in the league, you know, a 0-0 draw with Columbus and then losses to both, you know, Inter Miami and NYCFC. You know, outside of just rotation and resting certain players, what have you seen that's gone wrong in those opening three games that haven't seen the Union get off to the league start they would want to, especially as defending Supporters' Shield winners?
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint necessarily anything specific that's gone wrong. I mean, Columbus, you kind of expected that, you know, there weren't going to be any goals in that. I mean, two top teams in the league, both trophy winners last year. The Inter-Miami game, it did feel like they kind of, you know, they got the goal. And I think that as a team, they've kind of gotten used to like, okay, we got our goal. We're going to win this game.
Right.
And, you know, and then, you know, some things happen on the field. There's a little bit of history with Higuain. Now his brother is part of it as well.
Right.
And, you know, obviously they're playing with just a tremendous amount of emotion and, you know, obviously learning after the fact, you know, losing their mother. And there were a lot of factors in that game that weren't even soccer related.
Right.
But, you know, and you can tell from Jim that he's really upset about that one because he keeps bringing up how they were the better team. And I mean, yeah, maybe, I don't know. I mean, it's really easy, I think, after a game to say like, oh, we were the better team, we lost. But like, that's kind of how soccer works.
Right. We hear that a lot in Chicago, and that's been true for a couple of years. The Fire, there's been, you know, even pre-Raphael Wick, even in the Pano era, there's been plenty of games where the Fire played really nice soccer and lost. Like, it's kind of a recurring theme around here. So I think Fire fans could definitely relate to that idea of, man, our team looked better, but the scores certainly didn't say so.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, early season, it's normal for a lot of teams. I mean, you know, you can say, oh, New York City scored 5 goals. Yeah, off set pieces, right?
Right.
Like, you're not
FC Cincinnati.
Yeah, but, you know, so in terms of chance creation, again, and I mean, that's where you are seeing a little bit of a drop off from not having Brendan, where, you know, he's creating, you know, he created so many goals for this team. And that was honestly like my thought going into the season was, I mean, as massive as Ray Gattis and Mark McKenzie were to this team, the culture of the team, the leadership, you know, losing them was less of a concern for me than losing Brendan, just because of how much he meant to the attack. And, you know, I have questions about Anthony Fontana and his ability to create goals, you know, to pass the ball. He's struggled in that position in terms of actual like creating chances and you know strikers, man, the strikers are such a weird species. I've always been a defender. I don't understand, you know, they can have awful games and get 2 goals and then they can be lighting it up and there's nothing on the score sheet and people are like, oh, you know, they're not doing anything. Well, you look at the, you know, rewatch the game, you know,
right,
they had a great game, you know. So and you know, I think there's still some questions there, some, you know, injury kind of stuff, like, you know, Sergio Santos, who kind of feels like one of these players who, you know, the first year you kind of give him a pass because he's adjusting to the league and just, but he's dealt with so many injuries and just like little things here and there that he feels like it's like he's the guy that a lot of people rightfully point to as, you know, he's going to have a breakout year this year, right? Mm-hmm. And it still very well could happen, but he's just not like missing most of preseason as he has. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, it's really the point, like you almost have to count the weeks he's been in preseason the past couple of years. So that's, you know, that's been a challenge and finding the rhythm and Corey Burke has been through so much and coming back and getting hurt. And, you know, there's just not a lot of cohesion between the forwards. And again, Montero was lights out playing the 10 in Champions League. And, you know, just it the kind of back and forth nature of things, there's, you know, it's not all there yet.
Right. So we're talking on Thursday. Yesterday and Wednesday, Fire midfielder Luka Stojanovic said that playing a team as good as Philly, despite their record, is a chance to make a statement for the Fire, a chance to really turn things around. And I'm sure that the Union, facing a team like the Fire, who are winless and have frankly not looked very good this season, probably view this as similarly a game for them to really make a statement and say, hey, you know, don't look at the standings. We're still as good as we were last year.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting if you look back over the history of this series, some of the crazy things that have happened, especially in the state of Illinois. weird penalty, late penalties, you know, just like all kinds of things that have kind of transpired. David Akam, like scoring a goal out of nowhere late in stoppage time. I mean, so for the Union, right? He may have done that for the Fire at one point too. But, you know, so I think it is like it's one of those things where you're like, oh, Chicago, they're not great, but Chicago, like I feel like it's one of those things where it does feel a little bit like I think Jim had mentioned recently, like, you know, how, you know, coming off the high of the first Atlanta game and then being humbled by NYCFC, I'm not saying Chicago Fire is anywhere near the level that NYCFC is. I mean, I was really, really impressed by their team and how they put things together the other night. But it's still that kind of thing where you're managing a lot, you know, in terms of, and you see that in the Open Cup. I mean, DC United was the worst team in the league, and they won US Open Cup, right? So
weird things happen,
but it's also that kind of, you know, back and forth. You know, it's almost like, you know, sometimes I look at it like, you know, that year DC United had nothing to play for, like early in the season, like way too early in the season to be like, we don't have anything to play for because we're not going to be in the playoffs. And then they're like, okay, we're going to put everything into, like, you know, why not win the Open Cup, right? And then get into Champions League that way. So I do think there's like it's kind of almost like I picture it sort of like a seesaw. You're like, as a team, as a player, as an organization, you're kind of going back and forth. So, you know, getting on a charter flight to go to Chicago, do I think they're going to go in there and lay an egg? Probably not. But I do think if they don't go in there and win convincingly, it's going to, if they don't get a result, they don't get a win, I think that it's going to add to the anxiety of, okay, well, what is this team in league play and how do they turn this around? So,
Matt, I really appreciate you taking this much time, and I'll get you out of here on this. So, you know, with that in mind, when you watch this game on Saturday, what are you going to be looking for from the Union? What are you going to be watching out for that you might not have seen in the first few games, or what are you looking for them to correct? Just kind of, what do you have your eye on?
Well, I think one of the developments has been their set piece, scoring off set pieces in CCL anyway. And I mean, they have one goal in league play, and it was off of, I mean, one of our writers called it an anti-Galazzo, which I thought was a good explanation of it. You know, the ball just kind of popping out and chaos, and, you know, someone pops up, Jamiro pops up to score. But I do think the set piece scenario is going to be an intriguing one throughout the season for the Union because they're not as, again, Brendan isn't there and not creating goals. That's not to say that they aren't going to figure that out and get better. I just do think that the set pieces is the place that they're going to steal games with set pieces, because Jacob Glesny's in the air and Jack Elliott in the air. I mean, these are guys that are getting better, and they have a coach now who's dedicated. BJ Callahan went to the U.S. men's national team, and he was the set piece guy, and they were fine. And then they went almost 2 years without scoring off a corner kick. So, and they finally ended that drought last year, and they're already, you know, you're seeing them scoring off set pieces, or if not, just putting pressure on teams. And, you know, when you can pressure teams off set pieces, and, you know, whether it's you're scoring off it or you're creating, you're dangerous off set pieces, it can open up other ways through to open up a defense. So I do think that's going to kind of, for now, especially when they're still trying to find their footing. If you don't let them, if the Fire don't allow them to counterattack them, I don't know how the Union score right now other than set pieces. So that's, that most of their goals, all their goals have been off set pieces and counterattacks. So,
well, it might make Union fans feel better then that the Fire have had some trouble defending set pieces themselves. So it's always something to watch, but if you're telling me that that's the only way they can score, I could see Kasper Schmelko potentially wreaking some havoc with his size and his movement in the penalty area. So
that's an area of his game that you're seeing a lot more now too. Mm-hmm. And you know, you talk about one of the things you talk about with players as they age and how do they adapt their game? How do they find new ways to hurt teams? That's something that you've definitely seen from Kasper and how he. And also just drawing up plays to free him up in the box. He's very dangerous as well. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, I think he's looked really good in CCL this year. And I think, you know, he might be a dark horse candidate down the stretch for a golden boot chase. Cause you know, he hasn't scored yet in the league, but you know, we've seen what he's done in CCL. And so one of many things to watch out for with the Philadelphia Union this season, again, they take on the Fire this Saturday at Soldier Field. Matt Ralph from Brotherly Game, thanks so much for taking this time to get the Fire fans up to date on all things Philadelphia Union, and hopefully we'll talk again soon, because as you mentioned, weird things happen between these teams and there will probably be many more interesting chapters to discuss going forward.
Yeah, two games at Soldier Field this year too, so.
Yeah, well, thanks Matt, I appreciate it, and enjoy the game on Saturday.
Great, thanks.